Welcome to this special edition of the Global Health Insights podcast at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation. I'm Pauline Chu in Media Relations. As we mark the third year of the pandemic, we look at how COVID impacted mental health around the world. Elise Ferrari and Damian Santamaro are affiliate assistant professors at IHME, based out of the Queensland Centre for Mental Health Research at the University of Queensland. We know that mental health was and still is such a huge concern in the pandemic, and both of you have looked extensively at depression and anxiety. So Elise, let me start with you. After researching the many studies and the countries globally of where depression and anxiety stands with different demographics, what would you say the most important insights are that you're taking away from this research?
Yeah, so it became pretty evident early on at the beginning of the pandemic that, you know, COVID was creating an environment where a lot of the determinants of mental health were being impacted, and particularly the determinants of common mental disorders like depression and anxiety disorders. The work we've done essentially tracked how the prevalence of these disorders changed during 2020 and 2021. And we did see an increase in cases of depression and anxiety disorders as a direct result of the pandemic. What we saw were that women tended to be more impacted than men. Youth, children, adolescents tended to be more impacted than older populations. What we also saw was that countries where infection rates for COVID-19 was highest, countries where that had been most impacted in terms of mandates, in terms of lockdown, they were also more infected.
So Damian, let's narrow down those two groups, women and younger people. What is it about those two demographics that depression and anxiety hit the hardest?
So we suspect that one of the reasons why women might have been impacted a bit more is the employments that that women tend to be in were more impacted by, you know, the mandates, by the lockdowns. With the less secure employment, so more likely to lose their jobs, because of on average lower income, more likely to have less savings to kind of buffer any kind of financial difficulties there. We saw that prevalence of domestic violence also increased during the pandemic, and that's a risk factor for depression, anxiety. And we also know that, you know, women took a big brunt of the house, you know, the kind of the caring responsibilities when people got sick, when children couldn't go to school. So, you know, women faced quite a lot during the pandemic, and we believe this might be why there were larger prevalences of depression, anxiety among women. Among youth, youth are more likely to be impacted by, like, if there's an economic shock, they're more likely to lose their jobs, you know, less financially secure at the time. So they're more likely to feel the brunt of these financial shocks that we saw that came about when the pandemic started. What was a surprise to me, though, was, you know, when I started this work, my hypothesis was that we would see greater prevalence in the older population, because I thought that the lockdowns, the mandates would lead to more social isolation, that, you know, potentially the health being a bit riskier, that might be a greater risk of infection, there might be more anxiety there about catching COVID-19. But we just didn't see that in the data. It consistently showed that youth were more likely to have elevated prevalence than senior people.
Do you know why you didn't see as a heavier prevalence in the older population? Because as you said, that was the worry at the beginning of the pandemic, is that they are the high risk population.
I'm not too sure, to be honest. It's still a surprise to me today. Yeah.
Elise, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible that effect is there, but the surveys that, you know, we work with are not picking it up. If elderly populations are more at risk at COVID, perhaps they're less likely to be participating in these sorts of surveys. That's kind of one premise. So it's more about us not finding the data yet, rather than, you know, that effect not existing. It's also possible because, you know, a lot of those social determinants that we saw impacted early on are things around employment. They're things about, you know, being sort of less able to move around your community, about not going to school and, you know, not being able to, you know, be more social. And those things perhaps tend to be, you know, the change we saw tend to be more evident in sort of the working age group or the younger age group, as opposed to the elderly age group. It's important to recognize as well is as we're progressing through different phases of the pandemic, the impact, the mental health impacts are changing. And, you know, those trends that we saw in 2020 with women and the younger populations being more impacted, that's changing as well. So we saw a little bit less of that in 2021, and we're still digesting sort of the data from 2021 to make better sense of it.
So that's encouraging to hear that the trends are changing and, and for the better.
Yeah.
And as you have identified these determinants and you've got the data and you're seeing the trends, what do we do with that information now? Like, how can policymakers and the public use this information?
I think it's important to answer that question. It's important to recognize that mental disorders was a leading cause of burden before the pandemic occurred. And we hadn't seen a reduction in that burden at the global level. You know, we haven't seen that in the last 20 years leading up to COVID. What COVID did was essentially, it was a population shock that meant that cases of depression and anxiety disorders increased further, making that burden, you know, grow even more. It's important to learn from this in terms of how a population shock can change the prevalence of mental disorders and how the government response to that needs to be, because, you know, COVID was this big shock that basically changed everything when it comes to the landscape of mental health services and how people were accessing services for mental disorders, you know, in 2020. It's important for us to learn from that so that we're better prepared for the next population shock that comes along, whether it's an economic shock or, you know, a shock around conflict, war and violence, or all these things that we already know do impact on the prevalence of mental disorders. So that's one thing we're keeping in mind when we are thinking about research that's to come. How can we take this method that we've developed to measure the impact of COVID and adapt it so that we can measure the impact of another population shock?
So it sounds like it's an investment issue, an investment of where you put the resources. And I did see a statistic from the WHO saying that in low-income countries, there was less than one mental health worker per 100,000 people. So if you take that statistic and magnify that, I mean, what does that, where does that leave you in terms of where do you even start with investment?
There's been a lot of work done around how best to scale up interventions for mental disorders in resource poor populations, and how we would go about that differently in a low income setting than we would in a high income setting. It's also about prioritizing getting treatment to people who need it the most, those experiencing the most severe, the most debilitating symptoms or disorders when it comes to mental disorders. There is a lot of literature out there showing how particular, you know, intervention strategies can help decrease symptoms of mental disorders. So it's, I guess it's just about getting those strategies and those platforms for scale up to policymakers and in a language that they understand and able to listen to. And I think GBD does a good job at kind of putting that data out there. And you have other platforms like the Countdown for Global Mental Health 2030, that is also, you know, a good mechanism of doing that.
What more data would you like?
So one of my biggest concerns, I guess, during this task, to be honest, was actually the data quality. When we were compiling all this data, there was such a large amount of noise that we had to filter through. And so our hit rate, I guess, for good quality data was so low compared to what was out there. And even today, you know, I really want to see a lot more of these high quality surveys coming out. And some of these are starting to come out. So we've got, the Australian National Mental Health Survey that just recently came out, which is a very good quality random population survey with diagnostic interviews, and that some of these surveys are coming out as well around the world. But there's, I would like to see a lot more of them coming out and in a timely manner so that we can actually analyze this data and react accordingly.
I'm glad you brought up the quality of data, because the Countdown to Global Mental Health 2030 has just come out with its report and its dashboard. And they do talk about countries that are missing data.
Well, I think the Countdown to Global Mental Health 2030 dashboard is important. It's essentially a monitoring platform. It holds within it a wealth of indicators around mental health. So that can range from the types of indicators we generate as part of the Global Burden of Disease study, so prevalence and burden estimates, but also it has indicators around attitudes towards mental health, around stigma. It has indicators around service utilization, around environmental impacts or other social determinants of mental health. Essentially, when we put all of that together, it's a monitoring platform that allows us to track how these indicators change over time and essentially hold governments, policymakers, and all the stakeholders accountable for how these indicators are changing and whether it's within the direction that we need to reduce the burden of mental disorders within those countries. I mean, we've seen in the GBD that, you know, data can be a very powerful tool. Health metrics can be very powerful. And, you know, the Countdown to Global Mental Health is another example of sort of a tool we can use to try and guide the mental health response in different countries. There's a lot of data missing, you would have seen from the tool. That's true in the work that we do within the GBD as well. And it's important to take the opportunity to kind of recognize that, but also use these tools as a way to highlight where the big gaps in the data is and where more research on mental health is needed.
And Damien, did you want to add to that about the report dashboard?
Just that I think that one of the biggest limitations in this field is that the limitations in where we get the data, so that those data gaps. Most of our data that we tend to compile does tend to be from high-income countries, and the data in low- and middle-income countries does tend to be quite sparse. In our work, we tried out very, very hard to try to compile these data sources, just because they're so important to, you know, to offer proper representation of the global population. And in GBD, we have this philosophy that we leave no gaps. We leave no gaps in our estimates. Because when there's no estimate available, it is often interpreted as, well, that doesn't exist. So if we say there's no prevalence, we don't report a prevalence of depression in a location where there's no data, then that's often actually interpreted as, well, like, we're not even going to look at depression in that country because we're just going to ignore it. There's no data available. It's often treated as if the prevalence is zero, which it isn't. And so we often try to find ways to incorporate maybe neighboring data sources or try to find ways to still generate a modeled estimate for every location where we can, so that there are no data gaps, and so that no one can make that argument that there's, oh well, we don't have to worry about depression or anxiety in our country because it doesn't exist, when it clearly does.
So is the solution to spur governments to actually invest in doing these surveys or private donors?
I would put that on the onus on the governments. If they want, governments should be motivated to have good data of mental health in their own locations, in their own countries. That's relevant to them. So if they don't have that, then the next best estimate will be something that's derived either through a modeled estimate or through from a neighboring country or a similar country. But, you know, I would say that a government should be, if they're prioritizing mental health, but they should be trying to find, you know, how many people are going to be experiencing disability from these disorders? What's the current service use in my country? What's the service demand in my country to help inform their policy decisions?
Well, hopefully this podcast and the dashboard will work towards that. Damien and Elise, thank you so much for the conversation.
Thank you, Pauline.
Thanks, Pauline.